I'm Jason Wright, and this is the Texas Titans Podcast. Just like the name of the podcast suggests, I will be visiting with Texas Titans of business, academia, sports, or whatever their chosen field, looking for the disciplines and habits that have made these Texans so remarkable. Success leaves clues, and I want to crack the code to these Titans' success and share it with you. Thank you for joining me here on the Texas Titans Podcast. Well, hello and welcome to another episode of the Texas Titans Podcast. This episode is brought to you by Office Pride. If you have a commercial business, a commercial office, physician's office, insurance office, real estate office, I don't care what kind of office you have, it gets dirty throughout the course of business. And guess what? If you're a physician, you need to be taking care of your patients. If you're an insurance agent, you need to be writing insurance policies. If you're a real estate agent or a real estate broker, you need to be selling houses or selling or writing leases or doing anything other than cleaning your office space. That's why you need Office Pride. My friend David Stein is the East Texas developer for Office Pride, and he is also one of the top franchisees in the entire Office Pride family of franchises. And he's right here in East Texas, and I cannot more highly recommend both David as a leader and Office Pride, the company that he runs right here in East Texas. Give him a call at 903-534-0425, 903-534-0425, or just go to officepride.com. If you're outside the East Texas area, there's probably an Office Pride near you. Check them out. And when you do so, please, please, please mention that you heard about them on the Texas Titans podcast. David is David Stein, our local East Texas developer. Not only is a good friend, but he is a Texas Titan, a great entrepreneur, a great friend. And I can tell you, he runs his business with the utmost of integrity. They do a great job. He makes sure that they do the job they say they're going to do, when they're going to do it. And if something goes wrong, because, hey, that's business, he's going to take care of it. So you can always depend on Office Pride. So please, 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 please call Office Pride for all your commercial cleaning needs. Well, hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Texas Titans Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Wright, and I am so very glad that you have found your way to the Texas Titan Podcast. I want to tell you, this has been such a fun project thus far, and the feedback that I'm getting from all of you that are listening, I can't thank you enough. Thank you, one, for taking the time to listen, and then two, thank you for the encouragement and the positive feedback. I'm figuring this out as I go and doing everything I can to seek out interesting folks and do a good job of asking the questions that I hope you would ask if you were sitting in my seat. And those of you who have taken the time to reach out and tell me what you think of the show and how we're doing, I'm so very grateful for that. Today, I have a great guest, Jilly Allison. Jilly Allison is one of the most dynamic young professionals in the state, and she is in Dallas. She is the president of D Magazine, and I'll tell you, she's a relatively young executive and one of the most accomplished and impressive people that I've had the opportunity to visit with. So I really think you're going to enjoy this interview. Let me give you a little bit about Jilly's background via her professional bio. Jilly Allison is the president of D Magazine Partners, responsible for revenue growth and marketing efforts across D Magazine publications, dmagazine.com, and People newspapers. She has held roles as a digital strategist, marketing director, and community builder across political campaigns, private brands, and nonprofit and advocacy organizations. Before moving back home in 2016, she worked for Blue State Digital in New York, an agency and technology company that develops and executes digital strategy for organizations ranging from Sierra Club to Emily's List and Ford. She was also on the digital leadership team for Obama for America in 2012 in Chicago. She's an executive board member of Dwell with Dignity and the Coalition for a New Dallas, and graduated from Fordham University with honors. Like I said, a very accomplished young executive. And I want to make note of one thing. Dwell with Dignity, that Jilly is on the board of, I actually have a coffee table in my house house from one of the Dwell with Dignity sales that they held. And I want to tell you, because I have that little bit of a connection and I believe in this organization, I want to read to you what Dwell with Dignity is and what those folks do, because I think it's a great organization. Dwell with Dignity designs and installs complete home interiors for families who desperately need an environment that will support health and wellness. We empower families to lead their best lives and to thrive in a safe, functional, and beautiful environment. You can check them out at dwellwithdignity.org. Jillie didn't ask me to do that. I just saw it in her background. I knew that I'd been there. I believe in what they do. So there's a plug for a good cause. That's what I want Texas Titans to be a vehicle for, not just to bring good information to you folks, but also make you aware of some of the incredible things that are happening across the state in the world of nonprofit, advocacy, and things that are going on that I think that you might want to get involved with. So there you go. With that, again, thank you so, so very much for joining me here on the Texas Titans podcast. I hope you enjoy this interview with D Magazine President Jillie Allison. Jillie.
Hey, Jason.
Thank you so much for taking the time. So here I am at the headquarters of D Magazine in downtown Dallas. For those of you who don't know where it is, just drive through downtown on St. Paul, look up and you'll see a big red square with a white D in it, and that's where we are, right?
Best billboard we could ever ask for.
Exactly. So this is an exciting time for you and your career because you've just taken a new role with the Family Biz as the, you're the, actually the president and CEO now, correct?
President, yes. President. My mother is actually CEO.
Okay.
So
okay.
In
I'm
keeping
trying to
with
give
the,
you an extra title. I'm
thank
trying to
you.
Promote you.
I appreciate that, but I'm good with what I got.
Right.
For now. Yeah. So in the spirit of the family business, my mother's editor-in-chief, CEO, and I'm president, and my father's chairman of the board.
Fantastic. All right. Well, so let's go back into the time capsule a little bit and talk about what got you to this place, because we talked a little bit offline about what it means to come into a generational business, right? And it's got its own set of challenges. But before we get to that, kind of what's your background? Where did you go to school? Where did you study? And what did you do between that time and then coming back to D?
So it's been a journey, which I think makes me better at what I do today than if I had just had a straight path. So more on that probably later. So I grew up in New York. This was at a time, tying it into the family business, where my dad had actually sold the magazine to American Express in the early 80s. Okay. And he and my mom left to do work on national magazines in New York. She wrote a ton of books. And so we grew up there until I was about in sixth grade, and we moved back to Dallas when he rebought the magazine, D Magazine. It was in the decline. American Express did not know how to run a local magazine. Turns out you need to be boots on the ground and know what you're doing. And he, rightfully so, just couldn't see, you know, his baby die. And right. So we came back in 96, me and my three sisters, and he took it back over. So I went to Highland Park High School here in Dallas. Okay. Very proud of that in the
Go
community.
Scots.
Yes, thank you. I was on the Joel team.
Okay.
And then I went back to New York, actually. So I've kind of been back and forth between New York. I call myself half and half. Mm-hmm. I went to school at Fordham University, a great Jesuit school.
Yep.
It's where more of my political spirit was awakened, I would say. And from there, had a number of jobs, both in politics, working on both Obama campaigns. In 2012, I worked in headquarters on the digital team, which was a very formidable experience. I call it my grad school.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very serious. And then at private companies in marketing, including D, from 2009 to 2011. So I saw Dallas then. It was definitely changing. I think it was post-recession. A lot of people stayed here who would have normally left, who were part of my generation. Mm-hmm. They were committed to making the city better. I started to see that happening, but I knew I had a little bit more time, mm-hmm. To go explore and have some more adventures. So worked on the campaign in 2012 in Chicago, and then I moved and worked at a digital agency in New York called Blue State Digital, which was founded by a number of leaders from the 2008 campaign. Mm-hmm. So we had the opportunity to work across some political work, but mostly big nonprofits, you know, the Sierra Clubs, Heifer International, mm-hmm. Planned Parenthoods of the world, mm-hmm. And then also brands and advocacy organizations. Okay. So 4 years in New York, and then I came back to Dallas with much enthusiasm and spirit in 2016.
Okay. All right. Now, so take me back to, because like one of the things that you were there at the precipice of is the whole digital age really moving, because the Obama campaign kind of created what is now the blueprint. I mean, right. You don't have anything that doesn't have a strict digital media presence. I mean, basically, I think it was after that campaign, doing some of the work you were doing, that we even had digital directors all of a sudden show up, not only in campaign offices, then now you go to the congressional offices, and nearly every one of them will have a social media director, a digital director. It's part of the communications team. So take me back to that time when you guys are learning and figuring out these strategies. What was that like? And was it kind of like, oh my goodness, we have found this golden egg? I mean, just kind of tell me what that was like.
So in 2008, it was interesting. You know, we always talk about it was the perfect marriage between the messenger, the medium, and the message. Mm-hmm. And in any campaign, I think those are the three things that have to come together. But, you know, you think about 2008, Facebook was just starting to come kind of beyond the colleges where it had started, penetrate more mass market. I think Twitter came out in 2008. And because I think the overall strategy from the top was about empowering people and getting more people involved and expanding the electorate, the technology was able to fulfill that mission in a way that I think if the goal hadn't been there, it wouldn't have been as useful. Right. But the campaign really harnessed it and wanted to put the power, and so I actually saw the power of it to be distributed and to get people to, you know, organize in their own communities because we could disseminate things through message boards. And, right. You know, now it seems pretty lo-fi in 2008, mm-hmm. but, you know, people were organizing groups in their communities and all these things through, I think it was called MyBarackObama.com. Fast forward to 2012, that had, you know, escalated significantly. Mm-hmm. But even still then, you think about Instagram just kind of was popping in 2011. Right. So it's even moved much further from that. But, you know, by then the email list was about at 16 million. So email was a huge driver of fundraising and organizing and message distribution. And then to your point, you know, comms and digital started to really have to work together because there's no traditional PR release anymore. I mean, it's all out there from the start, and you have to be really creative with when we're releasing a new campaign or maybe something that's oppo-driven, you know, against an opponent. That all has the digital medium and how it's communicated, what it looks like, is just as important as the comm strategy behind it. So I think in 2012, you saw the integration really go to the next level. And I think now, from what I'm hearing on campaigns and my friends, I mean, now in some cases, they may not even have a digital department anymore because it's embedded in every single field. Yeah. And so I do think that's where it's going. It's same here in a media. I mean, we have a print product and many print products that are successful, but we always are thinking about how do we translate this online? I mean, you have to have the conversation together. So I see that in all the companies we work with too.
So as you're coming up and you see your dad kind of, I would say the business side of it, your mom's the writer. Am I accurate on that as far as publishing is concerned in this family business?
Yeah. Okay. Her background too is marketing and audience development. She's a great genius marketer, but she's an incredible writer. And yeah, that's definitely her.
Heart. So literally, I mean, so Texas Titans podcast, and you have two titans of, you know, publishing as mom and dad.
Yeah.
So did you always know that you probably wanted to go into some facet of either journalism or publishing? I mean, you end up in the kind of the digital aspect, or did you have other things that you thought about chasing, but they just kept pulling you back? And what were, I'm going to get to this because there's a quote from your mom that I read. It's so crazy. I'll give you the backstory in just a little bit and we'll get to it. But what were they like? Were they the type of parents that were like, Jilly, go do your thing. If you land back here, we got your back. We'll support you. We'll give you the tools, but go do your thing. What did that look like? Because I got to think when you've got those type of parents that are so accomplished, you can't help but go, well, maybe I'll do what mom and dad are doing. So what was that like?
It was actually, you're right. They were very let go and see who you are and we'll support you no matter what. And I'm like, number one parenting advice I could ever learn from them was, you know, the child you're raising is who they are, and you're there to support and help them grow their talents, but you cannot push them into a corner at all because they'll probably say no once you tell them to do something. So maybe that was just strategic the whole time, looking back. But no, from the start, I've had a windy path. I think looking at it now, it all makes sense to me, and I learned something at every stage, and I'm so thankful for every experience. But, you know, no matter what, it was always go try it. You can always come home. So there was always, you know, a place to lay my head at night if a job didn't work out or a new city I was trying didn't work out or, you know, new school. But So I always had that, and I'm very, very grateful for that. But no, it was definitely go on your own adventure. I think the reason I saw an opportunity to come back here is through the market. I mean, I'm a marketer. Mm-hmm. I love communication. I love partnerships and coming up with campaigns and programs. Like I'm a creator. I like to put things out into the world.
Right.
And so coming back and having this platform in which to do so and all the local partners just made sense. But, you know, I would say some of my other sisters are much stronger writers. Potentially, you know, I have a little sister who's probably writing a novel right now, actually.
Wow.
Another sister who's a very formidable lawyer. So we're all very unique in our own ways, as are my parents.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was definitely, you know, go out there, try it. And I think they're pleasantly surprised yeah. that I'm back here.
Yeah. So basically it was the desire for marketing that kind of, it made for a good fit for what you guys were doing anyway. So, all right, well, tell me this, Fordham. And I tell you, I'm interested in that is because Highland Park girl ends up at Fordham in New York. It's kind of unusual, and I can relate because my youngest daughter, she's going off to CU Boulder. And so it's like,
nice.
You know, Tyler, Texas to CU Boulder, people are looking at her like, what? You're supposed to go to Arkansas or Tech or UT.
Right,
what?
Right.
Yeah, it's kind of the same deal. So how did you decide on Fordham? I understand New York. Why not? I mean, she looked at NYU as well.
Yeah.
So I get wanting to go to New York. How does that all happen?
Great question. So I definitely knew I wanted to be in New York. What I loved about Fordham and what I'm looking back so grateful for was I had the comfort of campus. I had small classes. I had professors who knew my name. I had this very, I was also, you know, there's a spiritual reason for that too. I was raised Catholic and it was a Jesuit school. I'd gone to public school all my life, so I never really had that unique experience, but that ended up being a huge part of my, you know, shaping who I am. It kind of all came together, but it's funny because it's definitely when you're there and living in New York in general, you see someone with a Longhorn hat and you run up to them and give them a hug. I mean, the Texans have a very strong bond. And in so many ways, it made me appreciate Texas so much. Mm-hmm. I remember my first semester, I would say y'all and people like, where are you from? And they honestly asked me if I rode horses. Just, you know, you kind of realize that you've had a unique experience but then you come here and it's completely mm-hmm. normal.
Absolutely.
But it really made me appreciate Texas sensibilities, mm-hmm. gentlemen open the door, right. the small to big things.
Right.
And yeah, I think diversity of experience is so critical. So I'm excited for your daughter to have that. And yeah, a small school in a big city was definitely the right move for me.
Well, it's funny you say that because like I told you before we started, you know, I started out in owning real estate brokerages. And when people would come from the West and the East Coast to East Texas to buy property, they'd be like, oh my gosh, where'd all these trees come from? You know, Amp, where are the horses? And are you in oil?
It makes me so mad. Like, guys, we're not 1970s Dallas anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah, which
Well, you know, like I told you, I just spoke to Chris Wallace. That's one of the things that we talked about. I mean, Dallas is truly a global city now. And it's almost becoming one of those cities like Austin or LA where to find someone like you that's from Dallas is getting rarer because it is a global city. I mean, have you seen that?
Oh, no. I speak at things, fortunately, a lot. And I always, that's my first question. How many people are from here? And it is more and more dwindling. I mean, the hands do not raise. So, and you know, I always talk about this. I'm like, maybe we'll do it. But Dallas has never done a good enough job in marketing our own city. I think for so many years, marketing has been imposed on us, whether it was the JFK assassination or Dallas TV show or the Cowboys. I love the Cowboys. I love our sports. But, you know, we haven't really had a way to marry that up and out. It's always been imposed on us. And I think part of that is, you know, once someone comes here, then they're like, oh, Dallas is awesome.
Right.
But their first impression of wherever they're living is not that. And so I see that as part of our mission. You know, obviously we're committed to empowering locals and having, you know, Dallasites discover their own city. But I really think about, you know, how that can trickle up and out because I deserves it, frankly.
Well, okay. So basically what you're saying is Dallas has created itself and should tell somebody about it. And here's why I'm using that. Here's my segue. That's my creative segue.
Please.
Right? Look at me try to play professional podcaster. All right. So I guess it was probably a week ago. I'm bored and I start checking out this new documentary on Netflix about Bob Dylan, about some tour he did in the 70s. It was like this, apparently it was horrible. He had kind of come off, he'd been off the radar, was coming back. And Dylan, who never does interviews, one of the things he said was, you know, he's talking about how you don't find yourself. You never find yourself. You create yourself. All right. So then
I see where you're going with this.
I'm doing a little research and I find out that I guess you were headed off to Berkeley, California.
For a summer.
Uh-huh. For a summer. Okay. And your mom gives you some advice and she says, remember, you don't find yourself, you create yourself. And it was so cool because whenever I heard Bob Dylan say that, and by the way, I'm not one of these guys that, you know, sits by myself and listens to Dylan and reads his lyrics. That's just not me. But that quote, I was like, it's so true. And it's one of the things that, like I told you, I like to do speaking and mentoring. And I tell so many people, you are what you create yourself to be. And so when he said that, and then I read that your mom had said that, I was like, oh my goodness, that's like a reinforcement. So when she said that, what did you have some self-reflection and did you go, okay, because I know you have married both, you know, activism and professional, you know, career. Did you stop and go, okay, here's how I want Jilly to be defined and I'm about to set the parameters and go after it? Cause I think that's so important. What did that look like?
Yeah. I think especially as a young woman, maybe any young man or woman, it's not gender, but you know, when you're in college or in the younger years of your career, mm-hmm. it's this, who am I? What am I doing? I mean, you just feel the weight of the world on your shoulders and that you have to have it all figured out. Right. And so I talk to college kids all the time and it's, first of all, my first piece of advice is the first job you had at college is not the job you're going to have for the rest of your life. Yep. So just take a good job. Like, just take a job. Yep. Like, you will learn something no matter what. You'll learn if it's terrible, what you don't want to do and what environment you don't want to be in.
Absolutely.
Just take the job.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that's my number one. But that comes out of my experience because, it's not going to all appear one day in, you know, a message from up on high. I mean, mm-hmm. that'd be great if it did. So it's on you to figure it out.
Right.
And the only way you figure out is through experience.
Right.
So you have to look at that experience as meaningful and valuable, again, even if it's hard.
Right.
Or even if you're like, why am I, you know, working 9 to 5 at an accounting job right now? Well, right. What can you learn from it?
Absolutely.
What are the, okay, I like a boss who does this, or I don't like how my boss does this. Well, someday when you're a boss, you're going to remember that and invoke what you learned. So, yeah.
It's all right. So along those lines, so tell me, have you ever had an experience where you're just like, okay, I'm doing this now. I know what I don't want to do. Have you ever had one of those? Or have you been fortunate enough to always be able to go, yeah, I'm okay here. I'm learning and I'm moving forward.
Oh God, no, I've had many. Like, not this, but I'm going to smile through it.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think in college that was definitely, I did a lot of service work and I've done service work kind of ebbs and flows. I think sometimes when you have an eye towards more mission-based work, this is the pendulum swing that happens of I'm doing policy work or campaigns and it's very, you know, kind of sitting at a computer all day high up. Mm-hmm. It's very important because it impacts people's lives. Well, then you start to feel this itch of who am I really helping or changing? And you want the on the ground experience.
Right.
And so, yes, I realize that I am better equipped to be more strategic and higher level because I love service work. I think it's so important. But it is God bless people that do it day in, day out. Mm-hmm. But it's another level of exhaustion and just, I don't know if it was a good enough time in my resources. So I can get into more of those stories later.
I do want to hear about some of that. But also because, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, the value add that the podcast gives to that, anybody that's listening, especially some of the younger folks. So like I said, I mentor a lot of undergrads coming out that want to be entrepreneurs. You know, they have an itch to, like you said, I've told them the same thing. Hey, right away, just get a job, get some experience. And you reminded me of a story, and I won't mention the names because they're high profile people that they were working on a campaign. And very, very well-known person comes down to kind of manage this process. And one of the two, it was a couple, they had met working, and the now wife had just finished at HBS, Harvard Business School, right? So she's feeling pretty good, very, very bright, accomplished person. Doing nothing, not being utilized, just doing grunt work, filing, whatever, and complains the whole time to her now spouse about, you know, gosh, I'm not getting utilized. And he's like, well, you can go talk to the person that's managing this project. She goes in and talks to him, and only thing this guy says to her is, I would like some grapefruit juice. Would you give me some grapefruit juice? So now she's insulted. Now she's really mad.
Fired.
So she goes to, again, her now husband and says, you know, you're not going to believe this. I've been underutilized all this time. I go in to complain about it. And you know what? He tells me to go get him some grapefruit juice. What should I do? He said, I'd get the grapefruit juice. And so she goes and gets the grapefruit juice. Okay? He, about a week later, I've got the timelines mixed up, puts her in charge of like something very substantial. He said, I have been asking for like 3 weeks for some grapefruit juice. You're the only one that actually showed up.
Stop
with
it.
And so I've used that story to let people know that, you know, sometimes you never know. And I don't know if the guy, if it was just some kind of weird Machiavellian test or something. I don't think that was it. But it was just, it's these little things that there are going to be times in life where there's a difference between being, I guess, you know, not disrespected there, that time you have to be careful for that too, but there are gonna be times in your career where the work's gonna seem so menial and so irrelevant, but just do it and know it can pay off. And it sounds like you get that, you've
it's
understood
so true.
That
and it's
career.
Also people are watching. I mean, I tell you, I know, I spot them here, I know the intern that is gonna rise to the top. I mean, it people are watching, and so just show up and give it your all. But again, it might be bringing the grapefruit juice, or it might be sitting at a desk plugging away data in a spreadsheet. I don't know, but people are watching, and everyone is looking for talent. And so, especially when you're starting out, you got to hustle and give it your all.
So you hustle, you're doing well, you're getting all these experiences. And then again, kind of like what we talked about offline, you get a desire because you realize you're putting all this effort and energy into other endeavors that, while rewarding professionally, you have a heart for Dallas, and you've got this incredible legacy business here. And by the way, that's something that, you know, we kind of talked about. I mean, people like to make assumptions about someone who comes into a quote unquote family business, and they don't really understand the challenges that presents. I mean, because no matter what, you have to have your game above and beyond. I mean, I'll let you speak to that. I won't speak for you, but I know from other friends of mine who have come into the family business, kind of talk to me about that process of just the thought process of, okay, I've done these things, I've put these tools in my toolkit, now I want to deploy them at D, in D, with, you know, what was that process that kind of brought you home, if you will?
Yeah, it wasn't clear when I moved back that, you know, I wasn't just shoo-in, okay, I'm done exploring myself now, I can come home. No, it was definitely, I wasn't even sure. I knew I wanted to be back in Dallas, so that was number one. And I was kind of in a transition period in my career. So a position came open here on the sales side, working on our D Home product. And I took it. I talked to my parents. It's like, I want to try it again. Let's see. And maybe it's something in between the next thing. You know, again, there was no clear path. But again, in their, God, looking back, they're so smart. They were just like, okay, I guess if you want. Yeah.
And then then you left, and then they were high-fiving probably and hugging it out. Oh, baby's coming up. Yeah. No.
So, and what I learned starting on the business side, because I worked in 2009-11 when I was here, we actually created a different position that was about moving the brand forward and kind of a hybrid between sales and edit, which doesn't really exist in magazines. Mm-hmm. And we really recalibrate our marketing, and that's still a big part of how we do things today. But I never sat strictly on the sales side of the business. So it turned out, again, as things do, looking back, a phenomenal learning experience. I sat with our best sales leads, reps, worked with our clients, really started to understand the value that we bring to clients, and then also, you know, what else we need to be doing to continue to grow the business. But that started on, you know, one D Home problem. You know, we kind of talked about me coming in kind of through the back door. You know, it wasn't a big announcement. There wasn't anything. I'd been gone for 5 or 6 years, so I didn't recognize a lot of the people. And it was really, I wanted to have my head down and learn. And this provided actually a phenomenal petri dish to experiment. And then we also, and it was fun to see also what I had learned in those 5 years and like what I could contribute now, how I did see things differently, but also humbly learn from what they've been doing here. Yeah. So I kind of did that for about 6-7 months. And then we realized that there are different ways we could be organizing our marketing efforts. Having worked at an agency for the last 4 or 5 years, I became very dedicated and passionate about process and right. streamlining process. Right. And sometimes in an entrepreneurial environment such as this, mm-hmm. that is not top of mind. So I wanted to reorganize and recalibrate some of the way we had been doing things. But it's because I was immersed in it and I didn't come in guns blazing, you know, yep. this is what we need to do and change. It was really just by being in it. So that's, and then I stay, and then they haven't gotten rid of me yet. So,
well, okay. Now I want to touch on that a little bit because yeah. I had two similar experiences. One of the companies I worked for was the Home Depot. I worked for Bob Nardelli, a part of this leadership program. He was the first outside CEO ever hired, besides the founders, Arthur Blank and Bernie Marcus. Right. So, and Home Depot had this culture. It was almost a cult-like, you know, culture because you had store managers that were given this, on average, $55 million a year business to do with it what they wanted. And Arthur and Bernie had empowered these guys to really build these businesses. But just like you said, there were inefficiencies. It was kind of like this, it was just whatever, you know, whatever you think will work, do it. No systems, no processes, no mention of Six Sigma or Lean Sigma or anything mm-hmm. like that. So then arrives Bob Nardelli, and he hires those of us, younger, you know, upstart executives to come in and try to groom throughout the company. And so we show up, and these store managers, who are brilliant entrepreneurs, they really are, they're like, why are you telling me what I should do whenever I've been running this just fine without you? And by the way, with their stock options and everything, they were richer than most of us would ever be. And so it you really have to learn to give them that respect. You can't just come in and say, this is how we're going to do it. And then I went through the exact same thing again when I was 28 and I bought the real estate company I told you about. The average age in that company, it was a 56-year-old company, and the average age was somewhere around 60. And wow. here I am, 28, coming in, and my mom was in real estate. So everyone just assumed, oh, she has set him up. And so there's this showing the respect, mm-hmm. understanding, hey, I do respect what you're doing, but here's how we're going to do things now, and here's why. So tell me what it was like when you start showing up to work and you just know you're going to have some of that resistance. How did you deal with that? And were there ever any times where it was like, I just don't know if I can deal with this?
Oh, absolutely. I think I learned pretty quickly. And the lucky thing about working in sales is that it's all very measurable. Mm-hmm. And so I realized quickly on, and probably people told me to, I'm not saying I came to this on my own, but you know, if I can help people get some quick wins, if I can help the reps make more money,
yeah, right.
then they'll see that I'm on their side.
Right.
And I did. I mean, we want the business to grow, and it wasn't like we all have the same goal there. So yes, I had to sit back. I think listening is very important in those early days coming mm-hmm. in, and knowing that, again, you're not there to ruin anyone's world. Mm-hmm. You're there to help them make more money.
Right.
And that might just have to look different, or we might need to communicate with advertisers a different way, or we might need to track things on our calendar. I mean, it really, there's internal, there's external, there's so many layers of, I think, potential generational differences working in the workplace. Yep. Sometimes here, you know, there wouldn't be an agenda for meeting. I mean, little things. But I also had to learn to let go. Mm-hmm. And I think that was another, you know, you also come from New York. Those of you who have worked in New York and then moved to Texas, there's a very much a transitional period of you forcing yourself to slow down.
Oh, Jilly, when I moved from Houston to Tyler, it was like, whoa.
Like that lunch is going to take 2 hours, yeah. not 30 minutes. So you better block two hours off your calendar.
Absolutely.
And it was like a rough transition mm-hmm. at first because I was just, let's go. Yep. What's the meet? Like, we got to go. We got to move on this, you know? right. And everyone's like, no, I want to talk about my dog. And I was like, right. what? No, we don't have time to talk about your dog.
Right.
But now I love talking about my dog. So I had to go through a personal culture mm-hmm. transition, mm-hmm. You know, meetings that where we just chat, but then we'd get the job done. It just looked and felt very different.
Right.
So that was kind of circuitous, but I think understanding the culture where you are, taking some time to ease in, mm-hmm. to understand the company culture, and then you can start to say, well, why don't we try this? Have you guys ever thought about this? Or, yeah. you know, maybe we could test it out with this one product, see how this would work. Or let's actually ask our clients, you know, mm-hmm. put more of the power in their hands to tell us and get more data from them. So yeah, quick wins, understand the culture, and build trust.
Right.
It's important.
All right. So with the rich history that Dee and all of your different publications have, what do you see are the biggest differences from what got you here to where you're going to continue on? Because you are in a space that is moving and changing so fast. I mean, for instance, you know, so my oldest daughter, who's at Alabama, she wanted to go into sports broadcasting. And kind of like what we were talking about earlier, what the whole digital space has done, it's caused these cool end-arounds and these short, you know, go directly to the consumer, directly to the marketplace. Yep. And I told her, I said, Rylan, here's what I would do. If you want to do that, great. I'm behind you 100%. She already has like 4,000 followers on Instagram, and she's not even trying to be an influencer like some of these people. Yeah. She's a social butterfly. I said, you take that to Alabama, and you market it in such a way, you love sports, you're going to the dynasty of college football. By the time you graduate, turn that 4,000 into 50 to 100,000. And you think if you don't go to ESPNU and they go, oh yeah, we've heard about you, that you know we want that those followers to become our viewers. You can do that now. So it moves so fast. So how are you leveraging this newfound shortcut or direct to the consumer, if you will, space that we're in now, to take D and the different publications from what built it to where it's going into the future, and kind of what is your vision for that?
Yeah, absolutely. So what I love about it is that, you know, you think about the trajectory of our company, and we used to, in terms of how we would communicate with our readers mm-hmm. and the opportunities we could provide our advertisers, it used to just be once a month. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was our one chance to get in people's hands. Though, granted, they kept it for a while, and so I'm not saying it was a one shot, but looking at today, and I think about our digital team, which is producing, you know, 20 pieces of original content, not from the magazine, I mean, mm-hmm. alone on the site. I think about our social media lead, who is, you know, we're posting 20 plus times a day on various channels. I think about our events where we're reaching, you know, last night we had our best realtors in Dallas party for 600 real estate agents. And we had a weddings event at the Jelfis for, you know, 50 brides. Right. I think about all the other publications that are now on much more frequency basis. And so to me, it's, you know, at the same point I would tell an influencer, your daughter, it is frequent communication mm-hmm. that, but from our lens, it's the same brand, the same quality content, and the same trust that we've built with our readers for 45 years. That doesn't change. It's just the frequency and the level and the intimacy of which we can have that relationship mm-hmm. is so much greater and presents so much more potential. So, you know, when you kind of take a step back, yes, that's required us to adapt as a business and add on more people, you know, and grow. And there's like, you know, a lot more hard costs involved in that than just putting out a monthly magazine. Right. But for our advertisers to get, you know, on an Instagram where I know we're going to reach 160,000 of very connected Dallasites, like with the brand that we have, that's going to move the needle for them. Whereas, you know, maybe for a salon, a print ad, now print ad works phenomenally for a lot of our clients still. So when we cannot and we will not take our eye off that ball because it's still very effective. But it's looking at what are the other ways that we can reach and build communities online and offline is where we're going. And so we're there. I think we've done a pretty good job of it to date. But, you know, there's that much more competition because it's not just our competition. I don't see it even as other media organizations. I see it as every little thing that's happening in town tonight instead of coming to our Best of Big D party or another person on Instagram that might have the what to do in Dallas this weekend. That's, you know, there's just more. I, you know, there's room for everyone. I think we're really lucky to be in Dallas. But, you know, we got to keep our eye on the ball and we have to keep, just expanding and growing, but keeping the quality just as solid as it's been.
Right. All right. So now just looking at Jilly as a senior level executive. So one of the things that I always like to figure out are kind of the tips, you know, the hacks, the things that you're doing. Because I mean, I can't imagine how crazy your schedule is. That's why I'm so grateful that you're doing this with me right now, because your demands have to be incredible. And I gotta imagine, look, you're in publishing and you're in the, you know, the magazine of Dallas. So everybody must be, you know, trying to get a little piece of your time. How are you doing several things? One, what are you doing as an executive to manage your time? How are you staying physically fit? how are you self-educating, you know, and it, like, what do you read? What are you studying? Kind of what philosophies have you, like, I know for me over the last 6 years, I've started studying Stoicism and figuring out how I can incorporate that into my daily routine, you know, physical fitness. And I do all the other stuff, intermittent fasting. And, you know, I'm always researching, trying to figure out ways to keep, you know, the greatest business machine we have, which is ourselves, in tip top shape. What kind of things are you doing to hone the apparatus that is you, that you depend on to execute everything?
Okay, well, I'm going to need some tips on that fasting thing, because I'm not sure how that would make me more efficient. But, well, a big part of my job is wining and dining, so yeah, that makes it a little tough.
Hey, exactly. It's just doing
which I do not
job.
Complain about. Right, I do not complain about. So, personally, yes, schedule is busy. I'm lucky where, you know, haven't started family yet, but so I think there's an advantage there that I am very aware of, and I try to, you know, remember these days, because I'm sure, you know, in a few years it won't be as breezy, but that doesn't make it easy. So yes, we have about 2 to 3 events a night. So that's definitely a big part of my job, whether it's an event we're producing or, you know, a client or a partner. And then my day, I mean, my calendar is sacrosanct. Everyone in the company knows you can have access to my calendar, you can book it, but that if it's not on there, it's not going to happen. I'm sure a lot of other people listening can relate to that. Even my poor boyfriend has to adhere to the calendar. So we're on that. Hey, it's all about systems. My email, I really try to have inbox zero philosophy. That's something I've tried and really honed in on my last agency job. Mm-hmm. Not having your inbox be the to-do list is a practice that has become very, very important to me. And so don't look now. I probably, it's not where I'd like it to be, but that, the email reliance is a challenge.
Now tell me how, all right, let's take that for a minute.
Yeah.
What does that look like? How are you managing your inbox? Do you have set times where I'm only going to look at kind of the Tim Ferriss batching?
So
how are you managing it?
I book on my calendar. Uh-huh. I do the three times a day. And that's where I'll sort. So I'll delete, I'll flag as I need to do later. And by later, I mean like the next time I get in there, or then immediate response.
Okay.
And then if it's to do later and it's, I can like just mark it. And then I have my to-do list system that's where that goes.
Gotcha.
So that's my, you know, it's taken me a long time to figure out what works for me.
Yeah.
I tried filing and labeling and all, it just, no.
Right.
And then I have a weird memory where I can remember just random words that are in emails. So I'll know what to search by if I need to search for it in my archive. But I'm like a big archiver. Everything goes in the archive.
Okay.
What else?
What about note-taking? How do you handle note-taking and just kind of keeping, like you mentioned, electronic communication, you keep it organized by the flagging, just getting rid of it and acting on it. How do you do your note taking?
On paper.
Okay. What do you use? What pen do you write with?
Jason.
Moleskin? What do you
use? Now you're making me feel bad. I have a client, the Container Store's notebook right now.
Perfect.
And then I have different binder systems. So I do that. I have different binder systems for, I've never thought about this, the different publications, or like for right now, you know, I'm in a lot of budgeting meetings and different conversations that I haven't, you know, haven't consumed my time as much until the recent position. So yeah, all of that is so that when I have the meeting, I can bring, you know, it's funny. I worked at a digital agency, as I said, and I remember my mom came in to visit the office and she was like, there's no paper here. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh yeah, that's right. Like, and then I come here and then I became like, I love to print things out. And I do think, and even the young people on my team, I thought they would come in and just, you know, want to have, you know, whatever they're using, their iPad or Mac in every meeting. And I do bring my computer to meetings, so I'm not so pure. But they're all writing their notebooks. Some of them have paper calendars. I do think that tactical, it's how people remember. There's something about processing. Yeah, so I was surprised by that, actually.
Yeah, no, I'm the same way. Like, I want to try, I feel this need. I think there's just pressure to, and I'm not saying from, there's just, you think, okay, to stay in the game, I need to be all digital. You know, sometimes old school is the best way to do it. Now, I've started to try to figure out how to blend the two. So I'll take notes, then I'll snap a picture and put it in Evernote. And
I'm really trying
to train myself to use Evernote. I'm terrible at it right now. Like, what I'll do is I'm good at creating notebooks, but then organizing the stuff in the notebook, I'm awful.
No, and every year I start out saying, this is the year I'm going to do it.
Yep.
So praise be to all you who have stuck to that resolution.
Right. So, all right, as an executive, what's your theory on meetings? How often do you have them? You mentioned budget meetings, and what does a meeting look like? I mean, how do you run your meetings?
So with my team, I'm a big one-on-one person. Yep. So Tuesdays are my one-on-one days.
Okay.
And I block it, and then I block out time so I can act on the things that we talked about.
How do I get a one-on-one with you? Do I ask you for it, or do you?
It's on the calendar. Okay. No, that's a ritual.
Okay.
Once a week.
Okay.
And that's just important for me to have, you know, so that stuff that's come up for me, oh, I need to talk to this person. I don't want to, again, I'm trying to be email polite, so right. I don't want to bombard people totally, and it's something we can talk about. So I like to have that list running kind of throughout the week of stuff that we can talk about at our one-on-ones. Mondays is a company are usually team meetings. So we have our company-wide meeting at 9:30 on Mondays, which is a really nice way for people to share wins, mm-hmm. birthdays, announcements. We have sales meeting and then different team meetings. And that's kind of where the week is mapped out. Then throughout the week, you know, I try to do client meetings and lunches kind of Wednesday, Thursday, mm-hmm. and then leave Friday open for actual work, which is always nice when that can be done.
Right.
Yeah. So as I mentioned previously, I had a harder time with the meeting culture mm-hmm. coming back to Texas.
Yeah.
I realized that, well, again, maybe it's an agency. I don't know. But I was so used to bam, 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 let's get it done. There's no time for small talk.
Yeah.
So I think there's a happy medium.
Yeah.
I think we don't need to be robots about life. I think it's actually really important to have those off-the-cuff conversations and make people feel heard and welcome.
Right.
But there's definitely a balance. So,
yeah, that was one of the things that was always tough for me to manage, because like one of the things that I, you know, went to one of these, you know, we go to these classes where some consultant tells you how to do everything as a leader. And I thought this was a pretty good idea. I used to keep a small whiteboard outside my office with time slots. Now I would put up there the times that I was available, and my salespeople could come and write down, you know, they wanted this time. And it did two things. I really do think this was productive for me. One, it gave me that one-on-one time without it being reactionary. It was proactive. And two, I could decipher which, like for me at the time, it was real estate agents, right? So I could tell which ones were truly interested in learning the business and taking the time to be mentored. So it kind of distilled out the ones that really I should be pouring into. Because if you never put your name on the board and you're not producing, but then you come whine to me about how things are going bad, I'm going to go, well, wait a minute, what are you doing? And so that was something I tried. But I agree with you that I believe there's an immense amount of value in the one-on-one meeting versus the big group setting where people are kind of scared to say, I don't care how comfortable and open the environment is, you're always going to have people that are going to hold back in a group. I mean, right?
No, so, absolutely. And then, you know, Then I like quarterly. I mean, there's also the bigger picture conversations mm-hmm. and kind of quarterly check-ins that we have that support. But, we have an open office space. And I also have realized a big part of my job, and again, this is, I guess everyone knows this as you get higher up in the ranks. You know, sometimes I'm also a counselor, and it's a lot of listening.
Absolutely.
And people coming to me with their problems. And you have to remember that that is just as important as the spreadsheet that you need to look at or the report you need to get done. That time, you know, and I think my mom taught me this. She was like, our job is to be interrupted, you know? And so when I start to get, you can't be too rigid about anything. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to be able to, because our people are everything. And without our people, this place, you know, closes down tomorrow. So we got to make sure everyone feels heard, that their problems are being solved. And that was another lesson kind of over the years and kind of recently where it's like, no, that is a significant part of how I can help people in their job is to listen and know that I'll be there for them when they have a problem.
It's such an awesome point. And I'll tell you that, okay, so when I bought my first company, so I go from being, you know, more of a staff guy to now I've got the business, and people were coming to me with their issues all the time. And I'm kind of sitting there having this conversation with myself. I'm like, why are these people bringing all this stuff to me? And I go, wait a minute. Who else are they going to go to? I mean, that's one of the things that happens. So you're so right that literally whenever you get to that seat, the proverbial seat at the top, it's like, that's where it stops, you know? And so that does take some getting used to. But that also brings up another point that I've started talking to a lot of my buddies that are in senior level positions about. They have, and a lot of them, I see a common theme that one of the most empowering things they have learned over the last few years is the ability to say no. And that's not just internally, that's externally as well. You know, it's just being able to say, you know, I'd love to, but I can't. You know, have you got there yet, or do you still have kind of yes-itis where it's yes to too many things?
You know, it's interesting. When we so I was director of marketing until recently, and it was a very interesting sharpening process that happened for me when we were getting closer to finalizing the transition. Uh-huh. Because I started to, whether intentionally or not, have to say no to things, just knowing that, you know, that's not maybe the best use of my time moving forward. Yeah. But you know who'd be perfect for it is my events manager, who wants to grow in public speaking, and she can speak on that panel. Absolutely. And so I started to see it as more of like, well, it doesn't have to be me that does everything. Right. Let's tee it up to them. And so that was a cool thing that happened unintentionally, right, was knowing that, okay, I'm going to have to start spending my time on some bigger things.
Right.
Not that this case wasn't important. Maybe it's good for someone else to now do that. And so right, I saw it also as an opportunity to elevate others.
Yep.
Because while I might have brushed something like that off because I've done it a few times, this was a really big deal for her to, yeah, have that opportunity. And she was terrified of public speaking, but mm-hmm, this was the perfect forum for her to, you know, risk and fail. So that was an interesting thing that happened organically. And yeah, extracurricular commitments over the last year have had to dwindle down. And, yeah, you know, sometimes my eyes can be bigger than my stomach, but yeah, it's a sharpening that has to occur. And right, I'm sure as you get, you know, older and again, family and other things, it just becomes even more heightened, yeah, and efficient.
Yeah.
But I'm also very precious about my weekend time. I really try to keep that sacrosanct.
Right.
And it's really important for me to recharge, to spend time with friends, mm-hmm, and to not feel like I have to be working all the time.
So, okay, what about, do you have any practices like for mindfulness or anything like that? Do you meditate? What does that look like?
Yeah, I love yoga. I studied to be a yoga teacher.
Okay, I'll help you with fasting if you'll help me with yoga.
Oh, because done.
I'm about as flexible as a crowbar.
Okay, but then we're going to be hungry doing yoga, and that doesn't sound very fun.
I know that would be great. That's a good
point. Some juice or something.
Right.
Yeah, so I got into yoga. I was actually a dancer for a long time, and yoga was a nice transition for me as I had some injuries. Didn't want to do that anymore. And then it turned into, you know, so at first it started very physical practice and, yeah, a way to kind of get my energy out. And now, I mean, it's that for me. I think physically what I realize is the weeks I don't do it or don't do anything, mm-hmm, I mean, I am tightly, like I just feel it, and mm-hmm, it really does change my mood and my ability to be open to things,
yep,
and my attitude. So it's interesting how that evolves for you, how physical exercise.
Absolutely. It is the best head medicine that I do. I mean, it's
ever.
It's, yeah.
And it's not even, it's weird. Like, it's not about how I look anymore. It's weird. It's precisely. Literally just, I know that I will be a better person coming out of this room in 45 yep, minutes. Like, yep, that's going to happen. And so why wouldn't I do it? I have an hour to do it, you know?
Right.
So it's just, it's really become a different equation for me. And yeah, so I have my own practice. And then I really try to travel. Like when I go to LA or New York, mm-hmm, that is where I really dive into teachers and spend a lot of time diving in, not only the philosophy, but just sharpening my practice. So
you're able to, see, that's one of the things I haven't been able to make, because I do try to do yoga. I mean, I make
a valiant
effort.
Yes.
Because I'm the same way. I mean, if I don't, you know, do something physical every day, I mean, it gets in my head.
Were you an athlete growing up?
Yes.
See, I think that's part of it too.
Yeah.
It's hard to let go.
It is. And you just get conditioned to it. And like my latest obsession, and anyone that's listening to the podcast that knows me will be like, they're rolling their eyes right now because they know what's coming, but the Peloton. I'm a Peloton freak. Oh my gosh. My wife got me one for Christmas. And okay, so Jilly, the last I checked, at day 154 of owning it, I had done 147 rides.
You're a maniac.
That's how I'm addicted. I love it. And I do. And I don't go to gyms. I do P90X. I do all the Shaun T workouts, and I do my Peloton. And that is it. And within the Peloton, you know, if you get the digital app, it has all sorts of workouts besides the ride. So I do the yoga there.
Is this a sponsored plug.
No, no. But,
okay, well, they
but
should.
Peloton, if you're listening, yeah, you should sponsor. Yeah.
He's giving away free for all.
Thank you. Thank you, Jill.
So I'm just in the business. It's all right.
That's right. Thank you. Yeah, I will know I have really arrived on the Texas Titans podcast whenever
I think we should make it happen. Yeah,
Let's do it. Matt Wilpers doing a spot on here for Peloton, I'll know I've really arrived.
All right, there's a goal.
But no, I'm serious. But I do want to get good at yoga because flexibility is so key. But the problem is it's so hard for me. I haven't been able to combine the kind of the meditative mindfulness aspect of it with the actual movement. So
it's hard when you're starting out because you're just like, where do I put my foot? You know, I mean, it's hard to be zen about something where, you're just trying to figure out. So I do think that's also where class setting is really important. Mm-hmm. And that's where, and maybe because of my dance background, I do love classes for not only the group energy, but also to have an instructor who's paying attention to you and can kind of help. The other thing for beginners for yoga is, you know, you don't need to touch your toes. I think relying on props and just slowing down and realizing that no one looks the same. And so the person next to you might be doing the splits, but that's their body. That's their time. You just focus on you. And so that's what I love about yoga is that the world kind of comes down to this one mat in space. And that's all you're working with. And, you know, my teachers talk about all the time, like all you have to think about right now is where your right foot is. And that to me is such a nice relief. And it's amazing how it can just immediately, the other things in the to-do list and everything else, it helps me let go of that for a minute because all I'm thinking about is where my right foot is in the world.
I love that. I'm going to use that because seriously, I'm pretty one-dimensional that way. I like that. If you give me one thing to focus on, because I'm real ADD and scatterbrained.
Yep, same.
I like that. So I'm totally ripping
it. Yeah, it's helped me a lot.
So see, there you go. You know?
Just trying to help, Jason.
You're people helping people. That's what you're all about. All right, so I want you to talk a little bit now about just like anyone that has never gone online or picked up a copy of DCEO, of DHOME, of any of the of your publications, why should they? Why is... Because you do... I mean, look, it's a loaded question. I know the answers, but I'm the interviewer. I want people to understand why they should pick up a copy of the different publications and explore the product.
Great. So number one will be because we spend and invest and are entirely dedicated to a quality editorial product. This is me saying that on the sales side, but the number one focus of our organization is the quality of the journalism and the magazine. And that's something that is not true for a lot of other publications, and I can say that with confidence. And so you're going to learn something new about the place you live, which is another big mission of ours. I learned something new about not only the people that are doing cool things in business here in DCO or the new store that opened in DHOME, but in D, oh my gosh, I'm just going through the recent issue. Incredible stories about Peticola's Brewery. I mean, businesses, personalities, the best Thai food in town. I mean, you will discover the place that you live. And I think in an age where it's very easy to feel disconnected, we've lost, in some regards, a sense of community, whether you're not talking to your neighbors as much anymore or not going to church or you don't know where to find that. We provide an access and a window into the place you live. And so we really think about our readers as, you know, there's always a person in the friend group who knows where the latest restaurant opening or we got to go try this place or come on. Okay. Saturday night, we're all going to go here. That's who our reader is. And that's who we really try to cater to so that everyone can have that experience and discover their own city. So to me, it's just feeling connected to where you live is what we do. And then, you know, obviously the businesses that support us are the best in town. And so you're going to also discover, you know, great furniture stores in DHOME or great builders if you're looking for, you know, starting a new life here. DCO, great services. So, you know, we are selective about who we partner with. We want to be sure that it works for them. And we also create an environment where we know that they'll get in front of a great audience.
Well, and it's something that you mentioned there that I think is so key that I just a plug for Dallas in general. You know, I come from a small East Texas town. I'm from Sulphur Springs, population 14,000 plus. I think it's finally cracked the 15,000 mark. Then lived in Tyler, but spent a lot of time, you know, going to graduate school at SMU. And I can tell the listener here that Dallas is a great community. Like we sat down and within 30 seconds, we're exchanging names of people that we both know.
I love that about Dallas much.
And it happens. It occurred to me when I started going to different chamber events and that sort of thing in Dallas is that, yes, it's the 80-20 rule. You got 20% of the people doing 80% of the quote-unquote stuff, But they're very, very willing to accept another percentage if you're just willing to jump in. And I think that what D Magazine does is kind of give you a roadmap for that, yes. You know, to kind of play, okay, because it's like I go to a really large church out in East Texas in Tyler, and people say, well, it's just too big. I say, well, no, it's big on the whole, but within it, there's small communities within this larger community. Dallas is the same way. And I think, totally. You know, and again, I don't do sponsored interviews. This is just me talking. That's what I like about D, is it kind of gives you that roadmap of this huge community, but within it are these cool small communities. All you got to do is decide to jump in, and you're welcome with open arms.
Totally. You know? Dallas has the best people, and that I love doing business here. I love living here. I love doing business here, but it's because of the people. And you're right, yeah. Because there's an openness and a willingness to collaborate and to say yes. Like, mm-hmm. It's a yes city.
It is.
And it's how are we, okay, you have this idea? Great. Everyone thinks it's a good idea? Good. Okay, so how are we going to go do it?
Absolutely.
And that's what our magazine is about, is the people and the places that, you know, I think about the restaurant owners who they won Best Restaurant twice. So it's for Gemma and Sachet. And God, they had never done a restaurant before. They were, one was an opera singer, one was a musician living in California.
Right.
And they decided, okay, well, we've kind of been in the industry for a while. Why don't we start our own? And then within a year, they had the best restaurant in Dallas. Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, and those stories abound all over. And so I just, if you're a listener, when you come to Dallas, plug in. And we talked about it a little bit. It is a global city. And, you know, you said something almost identical to what one of my closest friends, he has a private equity company in Austin. And it's a pretty large fund. So he's always dealing with New York, you know, the West Coast out in San Francisco and L.A. and then in Dallas. And his quote to me was, there is more entrepreneurial optimism in Dallas than anywhere in the entire country. You
wow.
know, you go to Silicon Valley, you go to New York, you go to Dallas, all the money pockets. He said, Dallas people are just excited about doing deals, getting things done. And, you know, it's kind of like we were talking about, that a lot of people, when they think about, okay, topography or whatever, they think we all have horses, we all wear, you know, jeans, and there's, you know, tumbleweeds, you know, it's kind of like West Texas, you know, where your roots are. But it's not. It's the same thing with the business climate and the social climate. It's a very open and cool city. It's a great metropolitan area. And so anyway, that's our plug for Dallas, right?
Yeah, and I also appreciate a little competition. So I'm glad to hear an Austin person says that.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, that's a feather in my cap, so I love it.
There you go. All right, Jilly. Well, look, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. We're hitting close to the hour mark. But one question that I always ask every leader that I interview. So in Stephen Covey's book, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, there's in one of the chapters where he says, all right, imagine you're walking by a church, you hear music, you go into the church, you realize, oh my goodness, I'm at a funeral. You look and it's your funeral.
Mm.
So as a leader, where now you got, you know, you got the opportunity to move the needle. We all do. When it's all said and done, what do you want people to say about you, your legacy, and your life's work and who you are? What do you want them to say about you?
I want them to say that she genuinely cared. Mm. And whether that's a family member, a friend, or a business partner or employee, that, you know, whatever she did, she put all her heart in and she really cared about the outcome.
Awesome. That's fantastic. Jilly, this has been incredible. Congratulations on your new role as president of D Magazine. I know your mom and dad are proud. I know the community's proud of you. As a matter of fact, it was a mutual friend of ours that one of my professors at SMU that had congratulated you, Robin Pinkley.
And, love Robin.
And I'm going to get her on the show, by the way.
So yes. I grew up with her daughter.
Really?
She's my best friend.
Okay.
So she has some stories, so
well,
careful.
Good. Well, congratulations on the new role. Thank you so much for this time. I cannot tell you how grateful I am.
Thank you, Jason.
All right. Bye-bye. Hey, folks, I wanted to encourage you to head over to jasonrightnow.com. That's my name. Now, now.com, and check out my blog where I've got the Make Your Own Rules blog. That's kind of the theme, and it's kind of a different take on society says to go right, but maybe you should go left. And I thought I would give you an example. Rule number 8 was just walk away. The rule maker is actually me on this one. Most of the rules are made by either whoever said the quote, whoever performed the action or whatever. But in this case, the rule maker was actually me. After many thrown weed whackers, IKEA furniture, and other uncooperative objects put on this earth to destroy my happiness. You can learn more about the rule in the Seinfeld episode in which Frank Costanza takes on the mantra, Serenity Now. And so here is the entry from that day. I'm so frustrated right now. Literally, I'm ready to throw my MacBook across the room. Why am I even trying to get these audio files off my H6 recorder for my podcast? No one is going to listen to my podcast. However, I did the interview, so I owe it to my guests to actually go through with it. I've told several people I'm starting a podcast. I have to follow through, but no one is going to listen. Why can't I be thinner? Why don't I make more money? Why does Ryan Reynolds never respond to my DMs on Insta? I can't stand my stupid car. I should have been a lawyer. And the spiral continues. Finally, in what might be the last sliver of sanity for the moment, I get up and I walk away. Within 2 minutes, the spiral starts to slow. It's Saturday. I'm able to spend all day with my beloved fiance at her store, Hot Tots. I don't have, and by the way, she's now my wife. Back to the reading. I don't have to have the files moved right this minute. In fact, I'm under no deadline. It's not like any of you are out there saying, man, where's that podcast Jason Wright should be starting? That's what I want. I want a podcast from Jason, and I want it now. If you are, you're just weird. I love you for it, but you're out there. Have you ever noticed that a seemingly hangnail problem can quickly spiral into a near meltdown? One little frustration immediately causes a flood of every bad decision we've ever made. Self-doubt comes marching in. All of a sudden, life has taken a dark, catastrophic turn. I hate moments like this. I'm terrible in these moments. I've learned the single best way to deal with them is to force myself to simply walk away for a moment. My daughters like to tell the story of looking out the window into our backyard when they were much younger. It was a picturesque scene, complete with tall oleander, plush green St. Augustine grass, a large pine tree, birds fluttering about, and then across the window, a flat spinning weed eater finding its way into the fence. Dad was working on the lawn tools again. We Wrights have a nasty habit of taking out our frustrations on uncooperative mechanical devices. Now that I'm a little older, I realize sometimes when you're losing the battle for sanity, the best thing to do is just get up and walk away. Take a deep breath. It brings everything into perspective. I've tried the Frank Costanza mantra of just chanting Serenity Now. However, serenity never comes, and like Lloyd Braun so astutely noted, eventually it all builds up and you explode. If you don't get the Seinfeld reference, it means you're most likely too young. If that's the case, here's a viral bear hug. Thank you for reading this old dude's blog, youngster. Don't throw a weed whacker. Don't throw a MacBook. Instead, make a rule to just walk away. If an argument is brewing, walk away for a moment. Catch your breath. Look at the issue from a higher position. You'll be glad you did. Oh, and it turns out I just had the wrong USB cable. When I got home, the files were transferred inside of 5 minutes. Stay tuned for the podcast. Thanks for reading. You rule, Jason. So that is one of the entries from my blog. I hope that you will check it out again at jasonwrightnow.com. You can read the blog there. There's also a link to the podcast where you can catch all the show notes, past episodes. I'm going to be doctoring up the podcast website here pretty soon because I've got some folks that are wanting to support the show. I want to get them some space on the website, as well as I want to make it more of a place where I can give you some of my reading lists. I mentioned to a lot of you individually the things that I'm constantly reading and researching, and so I want to list some of that out there, maybe start kind of a, for lack of a better word, book club where high achievers can get together, recommend books, and exchange notes, that sort of thing. So I'll be doctoring that up a little bit, but you can go right to jasonwrightnow.com, get to the blog, get to the podcast from there. I hope you'll take a look at it and look for more entries on the Make Your Own Rules installments. Thanks so much, guys. Go crush it.